Welcome to the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR, where we talk to business leaders from around Ireland and share their advice on how to create the HR systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, simply visit www.insighthr.ie/podcast. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Okay, let's get started.
The recent COVID-19 pandemic has put many employers in the position of having to implement cost-saving measures. And judging by how many inquiries we have received over the last year, a lot of them have either made redundancies or at least spent some time considering it. On today's episode of the HR Room podcast, we thought that we'd look at this topic in further detail. Joining us from Insight HR, we have Mary Cullen and Liam Barton. Hi, guys.
Hi, Sarah.
So we all know that one of the underlying rules of redundancy and how it differs from a standard termination of employment is that it is the role that is being made redundant and not the employee. But I was wondering if, Liam, you could maybe tell us some of the situations where an employer might consider making redundancies.
Yeah, sure, Sarah. I suppose one of the main themes and one of the themes that's been looked at by WRC and other organizations when considering redundancies are the whole area of the change being permanent and it involving change within the workplace. So I think one of the areas are there are a number of factors which might influence a decision to implement redundancies. More often than not, you're talking about a significant reduction in business or in turnover or in sales or in the demand for a particular set of products or services that an organization might either be manufacturing or supplying on the marketplace. So very often, if an organization suffers a significant reduction in business or a significant reduction in turnover, or if they lose a particular contract with a particular supplier that was making up a large part of their portfolio of sales, they will very often have to adjust their costs accordingly. And one of the largest costs to a business is their labor cost. So very often, when they suffer a significant deterioration in business or in turnover or in sales or revenue or demand for their product or services, that almost automatically means they're going to be put in a place where they're going to have to implement a redundancy process. In many organizations, they decide to exit a particular market or decide to exit a particular industry or part of the industry or decide to exit a particular country. And that may mean they will look at redundancies. In other cases, significant enhancements in technology mean there will be less of a demand due to improvements in IT and broadband mean that services can be delivered in a particularly different way. So very often that may mean that certain roles within an organization will become redundant. So there's a range of factors which will influence an organization's decision to implement potentially a redundancy process. And there are just a few of them that spring to mind.
I suppose no matter what the reasons are, organizational restructuring can be very stressful for HR practitioners. Mary, what advice can you give them?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I remember myself very clearly lying awake at night worrying about such a significant process. So I would always say to HR practitioners, plan as much as you possibly can. There's a lot of unknowns within the redundancy process, particularly if you're dealing with collective redundancy where you're consulting with trade unions or employee representatives. These are highly, highly emotive periods in an organizational's life cycle. And you know, for many organizations, it can feel like a crisis. And HR generally are tasked with managing that whole process. And they don't get involved in every single element of it, but they're usually the coordinator. And they're guiding the senior management team on the messaging. They're guiding the management team who are tasked with selecting roles for redundancy on the criteria that can be used. They're involved in the consultation process, which over a 30-day period could mean a minimum of 4 meetings, maybe more, depending on the issues that a HR person is dealing with. And so I would say to people, you know, having as much support as you can possibly have in the background will make it easier. So look for people who know what they're doing. So that, if that means getting in HR expertise, do that. You probably will need an employment law expert at hand to deal with things like termination agreements or to provide guidance, either at the early stages of the process or throughout the process if things get a little bit tricky. You certainly would need people like tax specialists available, and finance people available to calculate redundancy payments. You may need people like outplacement consultants to provide CV guidance and support and career guidance advice to employees if the roles are selected for redundancy. And I would always say it's useful to have PR or communications people available to you just in case something hits the media. Sometimes, even in small local redundancy programs, employees galvanize the media and get the media involved, and you might have a local radio station or worse, a national radio station or national media interest in what you're trying to do as an organization. So it can be stressful.
We hear a lot about consultancy processes as well. Liam, when is a consultancy process mandatory, and when it is, what does it look like?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in certain cases it's mandatory, and in certain cases it is best practice. I think, as Mary has alluded to, it's always correct to plan, and it's always correct to communicate with staff regarding the changes that are going to take place. In certain instances where there's a collective redundancy, Sarah, and instances where, for instance, there's 5 employees whose roles are going to become redundant in an organization that employs between 21 to 49 staff, or 10 employees' roles are going to become redundant where you have 50 to 99 staff employed, or 10% with an organization with 100 to 299 staff, or 30 employees whose role is going to become redundant where you have 300 or more employed. In those instances, it's the collective redundancy. So there are quite onerous responsibilities on the organization. They do need to write formally to the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment. They need to outline the reasons for the redundancy. They need to identify the scope of the redundancies from a numbers and a description of roles point of view. They need to identify over what period the redundancies are going to take place and what sort of criteria or methods they're going to use. And they need to assign and facilitate the election of employee representatives. So in the process...
Or trade unions.
Or trade unions, absolutely. In that type of process, it's quite structured, as Mary's alluded to. There's a number of consultation meetings that need to take place, and they need to be facilitated. And over a 30-day consecutive period, you can't issue any notice of redundancies. So that's an example, or they are the criteria laid down in legislation in terms of collective redundancies. However, even if your organization is planning redundancy and you say, well, look, I'm only planning to make one or two roles redundant, so I don't meet the threshold or I don't meet the requirements in terms of a collective redundancy, we would still urge that you would consult with staff, that you would engage, that you would explain the reasons prompting the redundancy process, that you would communicate a range of options available, and that you would really dialogue with staff and give them an understanding of the business case prompting the redundancy or prompting the change. And in as much as possible, that any redundancy that does take place is done on an agreed basis. And if you do that, and I think one of the key words, Sarah, would be respect. Respect for the people whose roles are going to be affected. Respect for their families, for the mortgages that are being paid, for the lifestyle that's being affected. Because, you know, it can be a huge impact, not just in financial terms, but in social terms, in mental well-being terms, in self-worth terms, to any particular employee who is facing redundancy. And it's an uncertain time we're facing in society at the moment. So anyone, you know, you add in on top of that layer of confusion and uncertainty, the worry and concern about employment. And it really is, you know, a very worrying and concerning time for any employee. So I think while outside of collective redundancies, it's not obligatory to consult with staff, it would certainly be deemed by the WRC and Insight HR to be best practice to do so. And I would encourage you, all, any managers who are considering redundancy, to sit down, explain, look for different options, take time, consult, engage, not present a fait accompli in terms of what the organization is planning to do, but really seek suggestions or, I don't know, different parameters from organizations, and consider those very carefully before they embark on any final decision with regard to the redundancy process.
So I'm going to come now to perhaps one of the most common questions that we get from employers facing redundancies, and that is, who should actually be made redundant? Liam, how should an organization select roles for redundancy?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very important question. And it's probably the singular most challenging aspect for employers and for organizations in this context. So typically, there are a number of, I suppose, selection models that are out there. Sarah, I suppose two of the most common ones would be what's typically known as last in, first out, whereby the person who is last into the organization or who has the least service is typically selected. And alternatively, there's a skills matrix model where you look at a number of skill sets or objective criteria and select on the basis of that. And many organizations also use some sort of interview-based process, which can also be used. So our advice would be, again, as Mary has alluded to, plan your process. What are you trying to achieve? Longer term for the organization, what type of skill set do you need? What level of experience or expertise do you require within the organization? What's the business case prompting the redundancy? Is it a loss in turnover? Is it technology? Is it a particular product or service that you're no longer going to bring to the marketplace? More and more organizations, Sarah, are going down a skills matrix model. So they've gone away from the more traditional type of last in, first out process, because they're anxious that when they come out of the redundancy process, that they may have plans to grow the business, they're going to need a certain level of intellectual capital or capability within the organization. So typically organizations would engage Insight HR to run an entire redundancy process for them. And that's around communications, consultation, designing the redundancy program, making sure that anyone exiting the organization is treated with dignity and respect, and that the termination takes place on an agreed basis, supported by the appropriate legal agreement, and very often in an outplacement support service. In relation to a skills matrix, you're typically looking at a number of objective criteria around attendance, technical skills, possibly revenue streams, qualifications, disciplinary records, and length of service. And the key thing we would always emphasize, that any decisions that are taken are fair, are transparent, and can stand the scrutiny of a third party were they to be challenged.
So we have time for one more question before we wrap up. Mary, I'm going to come to you for this one. What kind of supports do you think that HR practitioners need when involved in large-scale restructuring projects?
Yeah, I think I probably answered that already, Sarah, in that I think it's always useful to consult with somebody who's experienced already in carrying out those kind of processes. So many of our clients would pick up the phone as soon as they become aware that the organization are, you know, considering a redundancy program. And we would often guide and support HR teams around what they should do and how they should do it. So I think it's always useful to have that trusted person that you can go to for support and advice. You do need an employment lawyer. I don't think I would be comfortable starting any redundancy process without having somebody in the background that I can go to for all of those little things that come up that you really are a little bit stumped by. Remember that the employees are out there seeking advice from third parties. They may have trade unions who are absolutely fully aware of all the ins and outs of redundancy processes, and it may be the first time that you have handled one yourself. And so it can be quite daunting for the HR practitioner at that point in time. But it's really getting senior management support and buy-in, as well as experts that you need around you so that you get to sleep at night.
Perfect. So before we go, I'm going to give you my three key things that I've taken away from today's episode. So I hope that I've got them right. Key takeaway number one is planning. It's really coming across that the process needs to be planned thoroughly from start to finish. You should understand what happens when and be ready for it when it does. Don't operate on the fly. The second takeaway that I got from today's episode is that things come up that are unexpected. So having appropriately qualified and experienced practitioners to help you, not just your HR provider, but also employment lawyers, PR, I know you mentioned, Mary, communication specialists, if possible, tax specialists, that's really key. And then the third takeaway that I have is that at some point in the future, you might actually have to justify the objectivity, the fairness, and the impartiality of the entire process. Now, not necessarily the business case for redundancy itself, but you might need to justify why specific roles or people were chosen. So that should always be kept in the forefront of your mind when you're implementing a process. So does that kind of sound right, guys?
Sounds great, Sarah.
Absolutely. Yep.
Perfect. And that really is all we have time for. So thanks, Mary and Liam, and hope to catch up with you both again soon.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for joining us today on the HR Room podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR that helps you create the human resources systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, go to www.insighthr.ie/podcast. That's www.insighthr.ie/podcast. We'd love it if you subscribe, like, and share the show with any friends and colleagues who are looking for fresh ideas on how to create the ideal workplace for their business. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or an on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Thanks, and see you soon.